today, the way you put today's session together, because it's good to engage everyone in the dialogue and to share ideas. And Janan, thank you for a great framing of the situation for us. And I was looking forward to your talk a great deal, as well as everybody's input. In terms of the conflicts of interest, I have been a consultant for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and I am on our Professional Society's Center Advisory Board, but there are no other relevant conflicts of interest. I thought we would frame this in terms of first starting off with the first question that we all should always answer when we have these sorts of programs. What are our goals to make sure we're all in agreement with that? Briefly go over some of the challenges that Janan reference, and then what are some thoughts about actions we could take? So when we start with what are our goals, we start, as Janan said, with the fact that eye disease will eventually impact almost everyone if we live long enough. Certainly by the time we reach our 80s or 90s, pretty much everyone will have cataract or one of the major chronic eye diseases or refractive error and presbyopia. So it's going to touch every single person as we get older. And the folks in Australia have shown with Hugh Taylor's work that vision care is actually cost savings through society, not just cost effective, but actually cost savings. And that methodology was applied in the NORC project that PBA funded and was presented earlier this year. We also know by looking at various data sets maintained by the federal government, in this case the National Long-Term Care Survey, that regular eye exams, as we get older, will actually reduce the rate at which people develop impairments in IADLs. I mean, that's huge. Now, if we get seen more often, we will have fewer IADLs. This is on top of the data about falls, reduced falls with cataract surgery, reduced SF36 loss with cataract surgery. So there's a lot of good news related to regular eye care. So I think we all agree in this room, and I think the public health community agrees, that the role of public health and our healthcare system is to enhance people's ability to enjoy a meaningful life. I mean, healthcare is not a goal in and of itself. It's an intermediate outcome. Health is designed to allow us to live a meaningful life. It's not quite, as some people say, it's not like we're quite, if we're in the healthcare providing business, being a mechanic to keep a car running. But the concept is that healthcare and health is not necessarily an end in and of itself. It's designed to allow us to have the ability to enjoy our lives. So what are some of the challenges that we see in implementing any sort of programs that we want to talk about? I won't talk about the four major things in any bit of detail, because you all know this. The first is that there's a growing demand for healthcare the way we practice it. If we expand healthcare to population-based health, at least on the outset, using our traditional delivery models, things are going to get much larger in terms of the scope of healthcare demand. We have an aging society. That's something that's occurred all around the world, even in the quote-unquote young demographic pyramids in developing countries. As Janan referenced, we have the ability to improve the natural history of more and more diseases. So that means the scope of people getting care is growing and growing. So think of macular degeneration and the fact that we could now prevent vision loss, where 10 years ago we didn't have anything that really worked other than a little bit of laser for macular degeneration. And then with healthcare reform, we're going to have greatly improved access to care. We all know that if we continue to take care of patients the same way we always have, we're not going to have enough doctors, not enough optometrists, not enough psychiatrists, not enough ophthalmologists, not enough nurses, not enough period, if we continue to deliver care the way we always have. We also know that the quality of care is very variable. Janan referenced the fact that half the people with glaucoma don't know they have it. Well, Hugh Taylor's group, as part of their population-based study, also showed that of that half, 60% have been seen by an optometrist or ophthalmologist in the preceding 2 years, and the diagnosis flat out missed. And the reason we could confidently say it was missed is that 98% of that 60% had a reproducible Goldman visual field defect, which means they had to have lost typically at least 60% of the nerve fiber or their optic nerve before you could find a Goldman visual field defect. So we have opportunities there. But the big thing that overhangs all of our conversations is the cost of health care. We all know that as constituted, health care is an ever-growing percentage of our GDP, and people are now talking about value, which is a background way or backdoors way of talking about the costs. So we know that if we provide health care insurance to people, people will actually use health care. It's true in the rest of healthcare. It's true in ophthalmology with some nice work that Jinzi and Janan did with the CDC a few years ago. We also know from the RAND health insurance experiment that free care improved only two things. Depression, blood pressure control, and vision. Okay, so vision is one of the three things that improves with free care. We also know there's a linear relationship between out-of-pocket expenses and the utilization of care. The higher the out-of-pocket, the lower the utilization. And the utilization is cut for both appropriate and inappropriate care proportionally. So it's not like people can figure out that I need this cure and don't need this cure. Care utilization just gets cut proportionate to inappropriate or appropriate care at a free versus a high out-of-pocket expense. And oh, by the way, the out-of-pocket portion in the RAND health insurance experiment is lower than any of the proposed deductible plans in the current exchange bronze and silver plans for sure, and maybe even the gold plans. So we're looking at an out-of-pocket payment that's higher than the highest out-of-pocket payment in the RAND health insurance experiment, at least for the two lower tiers. I mean, think about what that means for utilization. So we will get increased utilization compared to no insurance. For people who have plans, the increase in out-of-pocket expenses may actually not drive as much care into the healthcare system as people have been projecting. Because, you know, I lived through the managed care. I see many of you have lived through the managed care of the 90s. And I'll just take a brief digression. How much would you pay out of out-of-pocket copay to keep the same pediatrician that you love versus going in-network to a pediatrician that you don't love or you don't know? You may love, but you don't know yet. $50? How many would pay $50 per visit? Okay. How many would pay $75 per visit? Okay. How much would pay $90 per visit? Nobody. So this is a natural experiment. It was actually done in the New York metro area in the 90s, where one of the big major managed care plans found that the tipping point for driving people from pediatric care out of network to pediatric care in network was right around that $75 to $90 threshold. Okay. And so that's where out-of-pocket expenses can really change behaviors. It also impacts the utilization of really important care. So a lot of that data that we talked about the impact of vision on improving health status probably deals with the impact of vision improvement through cataract surgery. And this is data from managed care in the 90s in Southern California, where looking at a comparable patients, the rates of cataract surgery go down by 50% in prepaid capitated systems. So to the extent that future delivery models rely on capitation and prepaid care, this is what's going to happen, again, most likely, to healthcare delivery to some degree. This is not a single find in Southern California. This has actually been replicated in several areas during this time. There was one in Kentucky, there was one in Miami, there was one in Seattle, one in Minneapolis. So this is a pretty consistent finding that rates of cataract surgery go down significantly in a capitated versus a fee system. We also did a study for HCPR at that time, not now HRQ, that demonstrated that in the Southern California market, this occurred because of a delay in the cataract surgery until the cataract had worsened. We make no value judgments other to point out the mean visual acuity in the fee side at that time was about 2060, with a median of about 2060, and in the cap markets, the mean went up to about 2100, the medians were about 2070 to 2080. So there's a bit of delay in the cataract surgery in terms of when it's done. And so you can draw your own conclusions about how impactful that is for a patient's quality of life. So what are some things we can do? Obviously, focus on the future. you know, I mentioned Hugh Taylor a lot because he's thought a lot about this field and I think has made a lot of contributions to the field. And one is pretty simple things. We know that eye care is really important to people, as Janan said. My former boss at Duke, Ralph Snyderman, made a name for himself talking about prospective health, which is really to help intervene earlier. Now, of course, this is a concept that's very familiar to the public health community, but it's something that has helped improve the visibility of public health concepts within the traditional care delivery system. The second point really is a learning system based on data and surveillance and a feedback cycle. These are the folks that contributed towards the recommendations of the surveillance panel. The reason we are talking about the surveillance panel recommendations is it's a systems-based approach, because we're talking about systems. For population health people, talk about systems is what you do, what we do all the time, not necessarily what has traditionally occurred in the healthcare delivery models that we have from the medical side. So it basically involves a simultaneous two loops. One is to continuously improve the implementation of care on the left-hand side, and then the right-hand side of the loop that's linked is to continuously improve our data and our data collection. So this is a way that we can link the science of data with the science of outreach to patients. Again, effectively assess vision loss through performance-based measures and patient self-reported measures. So we want to get both perspectives involved. We also want to measure use of eye care so we can understand the relationship of use of eye care to the visual endpoints related to both patient responses and what we measure in our traditional means. Now, there are a lot of ways that this can be done. We currently do this through surveys of patients, but there's some things on the horizon that might be very interesting as a complement. One survey is the use of claims databases. Jonathan Javitt was a pioneer in all of this for Medicare, but now we have this for commercial age populations with Ingenix, with Truvin. There's a lot of vendors out there that you can get a pretty good representative sample of insured people in the United States. There's a Medicaid database for Medicaid folks, Medicaid Max. There's the Medicare complete sample as well as the Medicare 5% sample. Now, the current ICD-9s have some shortcomings that are addressed in the new ICD-10 that's going to be implemented next fall. So claims data techniques are going to become much more powerful and much more relevant, and I suspect could do easily 80% of what we can do if we actually had access to the charts. So whether or not we actually need to get access to charts for these large population-based analysis is uncertain. Registries are something that people talk about a lot. The folks in Scandinavia have done great registry work for many, many years in cataract surgery, so they can look at things like whether or not cataract surgery is beneficial to people by surgical site. So you can see here that 20% of the patients in one site had no benefit from cataract surgery, whereas the best performance site, pretty much everybody had benefits. So there are important lessons here for us as well. In vision care, the American Academy of Ophthalmology is engaged in the creation of a registry that will be rolled out over time to all ophthalmologists, at least offered to all ophthalmologists in this country, that can actually extract important data for analysis of how people are doing. So this will provide additional means of information for monitoring how we're doing. And then the last thing is I'd like to spend a couple minutes talking about market segments. In the panel observations, we talked about having defined populations or subpopulations by the traditional public health areas for disparities, geography, gender, socioeconomic status. And we certainly know about geographic variation mapping in surgery, in health status, relationships to socioeconomic status. But what we can also think about in a different way is the segmentation of the market by who uses healthcare. This is general healthcare, not eye care. I suspect that the data for vision care would be somewhat comparable, though the numbers might be off or be somewhat different. And what this shows is half of the population constitutes usage of 3% of the healthcare dollars in the United States. This number really hasn't changed that much over the last 15 years or so. The top 1% is 24%. The top 10% is 2/3. The top 5% is half. So these are very different market segments, if we think about it that way. And so the people that are in the bottom 50% we may want to approach differently than the people in the next 45%, and the people in the top 10% are probably needing a different kind of approach to providing care to help them improve. Fortunately, we have smart colleagues all over the world. Two I particularly have been impressed by are in India with the L.V. Prasad and the Aravind Eye Institute. How many of you folks know them? Probably everybody in this room. Yep. Because they have constructed very efficient models for acute care with cataract surgery, and in the case of L.V. Prasad, with a comprehensive systems approach providing eye care in their region, their state in India. And the concept is to push care down to more local levels without having people come into the more expensive, resource-constrained care centers. This actually has a lot of applicability to our situation here in the United States. The UAB group has showed with Cynthia Owsley that some of the key factors why people don't use care is because of transportation issues, as well as cultural issues and having appropriate communications. This figure on the right is from a poster at SJIM 20 years ago that showed, no changes I'm sure, that there's a difference in trust between blacks and whites in their healthcare provider, the healthcare system. If anything, I would suspect that the trust issues have become even more of a problem for all ethnic groups in the United States in the last 20 years with healthcare, as opposed to less. And so that's a major issue we have to deal with. Should not mention technology. This was mentioned in Wired magazine. There are actually peer-reviewed publications that we can talk about that show the same thing. It means social networks. There's great sessions here about social networks. Public health is ahead of the curve on the use of social networks to improve health because of the power of relationships. But this is something that, again, we might be able to create some clever algorithms to looking at vision and vision loss assessment with that, as well as ways of improving. If we think about that here, the middle half, let's say the middle two quartiles of that cost distribution, they don't necessarily need to come in to see an optometrist, an ophthalmologist, or a primary care physician in a traditional office. Walmart already provides, and so do CVS clinics, a lot of care for routine situations. How many of you folks have actually used one of these? Yeah. I've used them when we moved to Michigan. It's really convenient. It's nice. You know, it actually works for what it's supposed to do. And one of the projects that Janan referenced at UAB actually works with Walmart for glaucoma care. And so we can begin to do that. At one point, I believe Walmart employed 10% of the optometrists in this country through a contractual relationship. Pretty amazing. Everybody's got a smartphone, or an iPad, or a tablet. And we all know about the cameras, and we've all seen those pictures. How many of you have heard that PEDIG, the Pediatric Eye Diseases Research Group, actually now has an online visual acuity tool? Okay. And there's also a home visual field test that you can do online yourself that has, not great, but pretty good, reasonable performance parameters relative to Humphrey visual field testing. So this changes the way we can view how we're going to care for patients. And then when you link this with some of the analytics that are available, we already know for over 20 years that the use of photographs for diabetes is at least as good as in-person exams. And in some studies, as in this one out of Texas, there is an argument of whether or not it's actually better. And now the folks at the University of Iowa have demonstrated that their automated analysis of black and white photographs for diabetes performs at least at the same level as a retina specialist. Okay, so now you can think about a world where that, you know, middle, that second quartile down of people with disease who need to be monitored who are stable. Instead of coming in to see a healthcare provider and chewing up a doctor's time, get a picture taken, maybe at the primary care physician's office, maybe at an imaging station at your CVS. It gets sent in, it gets automatically read, you get an interpretation. Okay. Patients love it, it's faster, it's cheaper, it's more convenient. It may, performance-wise, pending additional validation, be at least as good as what people get today. Bang, we've taken care of a large chunk of the issues for follow-up, adherence, compliance, and cost. Same thing occurs in glaucoma. We look at the published data, and this is a really nice study out of Europe that shows that the machines that measured the neurofiber layer, in this case the GDX and HRT, perform at a level that is at least as good as ophthalmologists in Europe in detecting glaucoma through optic nerve assessment. So if we look again at this market segmentation, we can see where the different pieces are and how we can actually improve access on the implementation side through changes in the way we provide care. And then I'd like to do one last thing. If we look at that top 10 or 20%, in addition to the automated analysis, we could actually use tools to help us figure out what to do with patients in a more resource-friendly way that actually improves their care. And so this is work done by one of my colleagues at the University of Michigan, Joshua Stein. He worked with our engineering group in systems and industrial engineering to apply the Kalman algorithms to randomized controlled trial evidence. It's the same thing that NASA used for their space flights. And the net result is that from this, we can predict using a validation set out of the randomized controlled trials how people are going to do and when they need to get their follow-up testing. So now we can begin to segment people into those who are at risk for getting worse as well as those who and how often we need to see them back. And so I'll end by doing the cautionary note that we don't know when things are going to change disruptively because, by definition, we can't predict them, as Donald Rumsfeld said, regardless of how we think about his politics. There are the unknown unknowns. And so the great value of having this discussion as a group is with more people, it'll reduce the universe of unknown unknowns. So I'll stop here. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you.